I'm Carol, and I just want to ask you permission if I can interview you today. Yeah. A bit starstruck, so you have to excuse. I'm now speaking to the Honourable Mr. George Nelson. I just wanted to ask you, Mr. Nelson, when did you come to the UK?
I actually arrived in the UK in Wolverhampton on the 13th of February 1962.
And what was your first impressions when you came to England? I mean, do you remember the journey over?
Yes, I do very much, because we had a few incidents. Actually, we travelled over on the BOAC, the old British Overseas Air Corporation aeroplane, and it actually caught fire soon after we just before we landed at New York Airport. Yeah, it was quite an experience, because I was looking out and saw flames and thought, oh, there's flames coming from the jet. First time on an aircraft, obviously, aeroplane. And somebody says, no, there isn't. And I said, yes, there is. And they looked, and next thing we had something over there by the captain saying, we have to land at the nearest airport because we had an engine failure. So that was quite an experience. And that was in America.
And so from America, did you come by plane to England?
Yes, we did. We changed aircrafts and we arrived in England, as I said, on the 13th of February 62. And when I arrived, it was actually snowing. So again, it was my first view of snow. That was exciting.
One has to ask the question, were you prepared clothes-wise when you came?
No, not at all. We actually arrived, I was in long socks, short trousers, you know, the normal suit that the West Indian boys come across to England in. However, at Heathrow, they did give us some quite heavy coats to withstand the weather. So that was quite good.
Just wondering, in terms of that first feeling of having a heavy coat, and I don't know if they gave you boots.
No, they didn't. They didn't give us boots. All they gave us was scarves, a cap, and a coat.
Do you remember the feeling of the heaviness in the West Indies? There's nice light summer clothes, sandals.
Yes. Suddenly it was as if you were a David, you suddenly became a Goliath. In the sense that everything was heavy and it was down, as if you were downtrodden and you were trying to walk and thinking, why am I taking such small steps or not running, you know, because everything felt heavy. You know, it's quite interesting.
Do you remember why you decided to come to England?
Yes. My parents obviously were in England from 1956 and 1960, the latter being the arrival of my mother in England. And my dad gradually brought us across as groups, the families as groups. And I was one of the group of five to arrive in England. Yeah, I came to join my parents.
How old were you when you arrived?
When I arrived, I was 10 years and 5 months.
Obviously, you must have thought about England before you left the West Indies. It met your expectations.
Yeah, completely different. I mean, whilst I was in Jamaica, we were always taught about the mother country and the streets paved of gold and everything. So when I arrived here, I didn't literally expect to be walking on gold, but I expected something fantastic. And my initial offering wasn't what I expected, in the sense, for example, we stopped on the way to Wolverhampton, and when we stopped to have fish and chips, which was my first taste of fish and chips, I asked the question to the driver, where are the houses? And he said to me, see all those buildings we've just driven past, those are the buildings. I said, no, there's smoke coming from the chimney, it was like a factory. And they were actually terrace houses. And I was bemused, thinking, no, I expect to see detached houses, you know, that sort of thing. So that was quite a surprise.
Do you remember first English friend when you eventually settled in?
I think the name of my first friend, if I remember rightly, was David. I can't remember his last name, but that was when I actually went to school. And he was the only person who actually took me under his wing, so to speak. The others were quite wary of me, as I was the only black child in the school. Yeah, so that was quite an experience. And I can't remember his last name, but he was a great guy, and he sort of was my chaperone, so to speak. So yeah, that was interesting.
Were you in the same class and the same age?
Yeah, I was roughly the same age, because it wasn't long after that we were due to take our 11 plus exams too. Yeah, so he was a great guy, a really good guy, but the others weren't as nice as this guy. What an experience for a 10-year-old. The sort of thing you didn't expect would happen was happening. You know, you come through it at the end of the day.
So do you have a best childhood memory of living in England?
When we say best childhood memory, I think it was maybe the chance of showing how good our schools were at my age in Jamaica, because we, for example, was taught Book English. It wasn't a sort of a dialect or anything like that. So when I actually got to school, the teachers were amazed when I said, yeah, English is our first language in Jamaica. And there were certain books I read in Jamaica, which was due to be read prior to the 11 plus exam. And he was sort of taken aback. And the other thing I couldn't understand was the children weren't in uniform like we were. Yeah, they had jeans and trousers, but there was nothing matched as per the school uniform. And it was a case of, I heard that maybe it's because the parents couldn't afford the uniform. And that was in the 60s. And I thought, well, I remember rightly at school, the poorest child, no matter what family they came from in Jamaica, wore a uniform. And some might not have had shoes on their feet, but they were smart, you know. So that was my sort of first impression, really, of school in England.
What did you do as your first job? Did you always want to be in the army, and did you dream of that?
Not at all. My mother always wanted to have a real profession, and he was either going to be a doctor, a dentist, or something like that. And unfortunately, one of the things I always wanted to do was to leave school and go to work, not university, not college, and earn my first wage packet and bring my brown envelope home to my mother. Unfortunately, that didn't happen because I lost my mom. She passed away on the 9th of February 1964. At the tender age of 43, which is really sad. And I think from then on, my whole life changed. Just wanted to be on my own. I just wanted to, you know, sort of move away from the family and do something totally different. And that's when the idea of joining the army came to me. You know, it was sad, but yeah. So really, my first job, I joined the army boy service at 15 years and 9 months. Yeah, so I joined boy service then August 1967, and I trained as a driver radio operator and a clerk, RE, Royal Engineers.
Did that take you around the country first, or did you start going away from the country?
Not initially, no, because as a boy soldier, you're trained ready for the adult service, so you do certain training, and from that, once you have passed out of junior service, you then go and join adult service and do another trade and become a soldier, really. So really, I didn't start traveling until I was sort of 17 and a half or 18 years old. But yeah, I didn't start traveling until I was in adult service.
And they just kept you in the one area?
Oh no, I was posted. My first adult service was to Paderborn in West Germany, and from there I was then posted to Iserlohn in Germany. And then I spent about a year or 2 years there. And it was during that time, 1969, that I did my first tour as an 18-year-old in Northern Ireland. Yeah, which was quite an experience. But yeah, and then from there, I moved on and went to the commando unit in Plymouth in 1971. I did a few years there, including tours, obviously, in Malta, Cyprus, Gibraltar, that sort of thing. So yeah, it was very interesting. I thoroughly enjoyed it. That was really good.
I'm assuming that there weren't that many soldiers of colour then.
No, there wasn't. There was many units I went to where I was the only one for several years. I mean, in the commando unit, I was the only one there for about 2 to 3 years. Very good. It was quite an experience.
I can only guess that you kind of stood out as one of the best.
That's me, yeah, certainly. I mean, going back when I joined junior service, I remember the intake was quite large at the time, maybe 600, something like that. And it was a case of they had three different companies, A, B, and C company. And I remember a corporal at the time looking around and saying to his senior NCO or sergeant, "Oh, Sarge, I think we've got one." And I didn't really click at the time until I looked around and realised that I was the only black face in the whole group. So that was quite fun.
Did it kind of urge you to really show your good stuff that you had?
I think that's what kept me going, because you can imagine in the 60s, early 60s, I mean, that was 1967. So you can well understand from then on, it sort of set my goals and what I wanted to achieve, and the fact that I wouldn't let anything deter me from you know, making my goals. And there was lots of trials, obviously, but I just kept smiling. And that's it.
You were in places like Gibraltar and Crete. Pavilions, did they come up to you?
Yes, some. I must say, some places were quite curious that me, as a black soldier, actually, for instance, share the same barracks and everything with them. And there was a fantastic incident that happened in America when we went to America with the British Army. The Americans were really strange, you know. The white soldiers couldn't believe that I shared the same room and everything else as the white soldiers. We weren't segregated like the American Army were. And I remember someone saying, "Where do you sleep?" And I said, "Oh, they issue me with a tent." And I sleep in the field. It was quite funny, actually. And my friends were just laughing and smiling. And yeah, it was very strange, that one. But that sort of thing only happened, as I said, in America, where the white American soldiers were confused and bemused that I could sit with my fellow soldiers and eat with them in the same place. It's really strange, but we got over that so that was a good experience, but it was very difficult. They couldn't understand it. I got that a lot, but after a while it sort of wore off, because people, as you go on through the years, really, when you went somewhere, they accepted you as one of the team. They didn't try and segregate you or saying you shouldn't be at the same place where they are. You know, and I suppose that's what kept me going throughout the years.
Rather wondering whether you had celebrity status.
I think with all the little areas of prejudice, etc., that you would encounter. Yes, I count them, but I got through it because of my personality and the fact that I wasn't going to be deterred for what I wanted to achieve. You know, I made a good choice. I think I made a good choice throughout my career. And to be honest with you, Carl, I'll do it all over again. And there's not much I would change. And I try to instill in other black children or guys who wants to join the army that it is a good place, it is a good career, and if you do what you're asked to do, there shouldn't be a problem. You know, my achievements overall was considering the situation in the 60s up to date was quite good. Altogether, I did 39 years in the army, so really, I knew nothing else. But the discipline and everything else molded me to and enabled me to achieve what I wanted to achieve. It wasn't easy, but I achieved it. In theory, my career went from a sapper, which is what the engineers, privates are known as, sappers, and finished in 2003, 2006 as a lieutenant colonel. So, you know, I'm proud of that. I'm proud of that achievement. You know, it's and I met some fantastic people along the way. not just officers, but soldiers who I'm still in touch with now. You know, and it's great. It's great. It really is good. And I'd like to use myself as an example to the other guy to say that you can do it and you can achieve if you just put your mind to it. Yeah, shut your mind up from the bad things and just project yourself on the good things. And I'm still enjoying life. That's the good thing about it.
With all of the travelling, how easy was it to find someone to love?
Believe it or not, it was very difficult. As I said, you know, my father being a strict West Indian and religious man, you couldn't just play around. He used to say to me, right, whatever any of my sons do, I mean, there's 13 of us in the family, 9 boys, 4 girls. And there's no way, he was always insisting, I do not want the young lady knocking on my front door and saying that she has a child for any of my son and they're not married. He might be old-fashioned to a lot of people, but he's so right. So, funny enough, the young lady I met, I must have been about 17, I think she was 16 when I first met her. And, you know, you always get this initial thing, feeling, thinking, oh, I think I'm going to marry that girl one day. People laughed at anyway, and and we met in sort of 68, I think it was, and we just communicated by letters, etc. But then we eventually got married in 1975, and had two lovely children, Yolanda, which is the first one, and Damien, my son. So, you know, life has been absolutely brilliant. You couldn't ask for better. Oh, unbelievable. Yeah, because if I can be of some assistance to others, be a light to them, then I'm more than happy. It's been an incredible life for me anyway, you know. And of course, as I said, I lost, both my parents have gone now, but they've left a legacy. For more, Carol, for more. And hopefully my intention, and I have done it so far, is to portray all this and hand that down to my two children, who eventually will have that down to their kids.